It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, find out why Wisconsin has the second highest rate in the nation of prisoners who are incarcerated for a crime they committed when they were 17 years old or younger. First, does it sometimes feel like your family or maybe your close group of friends speaks its own language? If so, you're not alone. What you're speaking is called a familect. That's a unique set of words or phrases created and used within a tight-knit social group. These private languages, these family dialects, can tell us a lot about their speakers and their relationships with one another. The term familect was originally coined for multilingual families, but the term has since evolved. Now it could apply to the unique language of any close social unit. It's a topic of interest to word nerds like maybe you, and certainly our next guest. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Okay, do you have some of these words and phrases that are unique, maybe in your family or maybe your group of friends or a workplace? How did that word or those phrases come about? What's the story behind it? Was it the result of a mispronunciation, a funny circumstance, a strange interaction? Call in now with yours at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Martha Barnett is a co-host of Away with Words, a public radio show about language. You can hear the show on the Ideas Network on Sunday mornings at 9. She's the author of several books on word origins. Martha, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Great to be here.
Well, can you tell us a little more about what a familect, apart from being hard to say, a familect actually is?
Yeah, you have it right. A familect is like a dialect. A dialect is a regional variety of language that's distinguished by its vocabulary, pronunciation, and grammar. And a familect is that same kind of thing, only much smaller. It's a private slang. It's that unique vocabulary of words and phrases, and sometimes different pronunciations that belong to a family or, as you said, a close-knit social group. And what makes them so much fun, in part, is that they're often completely unintelligible to somebody outside your family. And that's one of the things that's really great about these familects is it's all about connection. They help us feel like family. It gives us a sense of intimacy. You know, it's like any kind of slang that's shared by a group reinforces the idea that, hey, we all belong to each other. We understand each other. We have a history. And, you know, sometimes these words and phrases will stick with us for life. They're so special and so uniquely identified with dad or grandma that sometimes that word or phrase is going to end up in that person's obituary. We see that a lot.
And you have a great data set among Away with Words listeners. Do you hear a lot of these examples of unique words and phrases from families?
Oh, my gosh, all the time. It's so much fun. A lot of times they arise spontaneously. It's what a linguist referred to as the effervescence, the effervescing of language, like from childhood misunderstandings or mispronunciations. Maybe your toddler couldn't say the word phone. And to this day, everybody in the household says, hey, hand me my flown, you know, or my little brother couldn't pronounce my name, Martha. And so for years and years and years after he was, you know, a public speaker, I was still Mimi in the family. Or, you know, little kids will come up with, you know, barsh barrels for marshmallows or hiccup truck. We heard that one from a listener. And sometimes, you know, even within a couple, you'll have your own language. You know, you'll be on your own planet linguistically. And maybe you were texting back and forth and autocorrect changed your message to something hilarious. And you just keep using that word.
One of my favorites in my family is when our kids were littler, we went to this park, is a little further away. It had a seesaw shaped like a hot dog. So, of course, we called it Hot Dog Seesaw Park. Well, the seesaw broke. They took it out. And we still call it Hot Dog Seesaw Park years later. And it would have absolutely no meaning to anyone, even if they played in that park every day.
That's a great one.
We're talking to Martha Barnett from A Way with Words about family dialects, familects, those unique words and phrases that can happen within a family or maybe a other tight social group. And we're hoping to hear some of your examples at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ginny is with us now in Lancaster. Ginny, hello.
Hello.
You've got an example for us?
Hi, Ginny.
Yes. So in the mid to late 70s, I played on the women's basketball team at the UW. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, this word was developed, and we would say it meant like you're not doing anything. You're just being. And so, mm-hmm. like, the word was cartonite. So if somebody asked you what you were doing, you'd say, I'm cartonizing. Or you're engaging in cartonization. I mean, it was just this random thing that we developed as a team. I guess it was a team elect kind of thing. Maybe.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Ginny, I want to ask, is this something that happened off the court, or could you say something was cartonizing on the court? Like, yeah, you're out there, but you're not defending, you know, your assignment or whatever. You're cartonizing on the court.
I think we mainly tried to do it off the court.
Well, I hope
so. We
didn't
get in trouble. Yeah.
Ginny, thanks so much. I would bet sports teams are, you know, you're with these people a lot in very intense situations,
right.
Martha. That seems like a perfect environment for some of these word inventions.
Boy, it sure does. Yeah, any small, close-knit group like that is going to develop their own shorthand. And it's much more efficient that way, but it can be so much fun. I mean, I'll bet that when she texts with her ex-teammates now, you know, they can still use that word and everybody knows what it means. It's sort of like this wonderful verbal photo album.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Ginny, at 800-642-1234. Well, I hope the Central Time team doesn't accuse me of cartonizing through the day now. Marcus is with us next in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So when my grandma was alive, she used to say that you really only needed three movies to understand life. That was White Christmas, It's a Wonderful Life, and The Godfather. And so she used to quote to us pretty heavily out of those three movies. But two that stuck around is from White Christmas. Let's just say we're doing it for a pal in the army, you know, which is sometimes let's just say it's for a pal in the army or just a pal. You know, it's like a tenuous connection where you're kind of obligated and you should do this, but you really don't want to. And so that's mm-hmm. when he's pointing his fake arm and rubbing it. And then the other one from White Christmas that she used a lot and we still continue to use is snood. Meaning like a stash or a hoard of, you know, like if we were keeping chips in our room as children and as teenagers and we had them in Tupperware, all of a sudden we come down and we're eating Sun Chips. My dad might look at us and be like, where'd you just pull those out of your snood? And it's like, it's a reserve that you probably shouldn't have or you should be more sharing with the rest of the family.
Okay, Marcus, I got to ask, one of those movies is an odd one out. Where did The Godfather come into it? Did grandma make you an offer you can't refuse? Like, you're going to eat dinner or did you have to keep your friends close, your enemies closer? Where did that fit in?
Rob, I don't want to have to come with a signed check and Luca Brasi. That's all I got to say.
All right. Marcus, thank you so much. Now, this is another category, Martha. In a band I've been in for a long many years, we could exist solely, I think, on certain movie references. Does this end up being part of our shared tight-knit language?
Oh, sure. You know, a family sits around watching TV night after night, and you just pick up different words and phrases. The one that's going around in our house is off you pup, which we had never heard until we started watching the British baking show. And, you know, when they send the judges away for a little bit, they say off you pup. And now we just say that. And I think we're going to be using that for quite a while.
Marcus, thank you so much for sharing that story. We're talking to Martha Barnett, co-host of A Way with Words. We're looking at familects, family dialects, the unique made-up languages or words and phrases that we share with our families or our basketball team or other tight-knit group of friends and colleagues. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have one of these? Do you have many of these? Maybe one with your family, one with your coworkers, one with I don't know who. Love to hear some of your great examples and where they came from at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation about Familects, the unique words and phrases we share with our families or other close relationships. Martha Barnett is with us, co-host of the radio show A Way with Words. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Want to hear your unique words in your family? You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or call 800-642-1234. Amanda is with us now in Watertown. Hi there, Amanda.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah, what is your word for us?
I've actually got two. There's words that my daughter couldn't say when she was growing up. She couldn't say you're welcome. She always said whack-em. And so we would say whack-em, whack-em, and that went well into her teens. And we would try to teach her to call our cats to her. So we'd say, come here. We'd do the kissy sound, and she'd go, meer. And she, again, it's one of those things that has just stuck with us. I mean, we just went and visited her a couple weeks ago in college, and we did it again, and always has the motions and the whole sound effects and everything.
All right, let's try it. Amanda, thank you for calling.
Whack-em, whack-em.
Also awesome. Thank you, Amanda, for that. Now, Martha, we had some of those, the kids couldn't pronounce potty, so pot it was the word for a bathroom for a long time. Is this a pretty common, that kid mispronunciation, pretty common source of these Familect words?
Calls about those all the time. And they're just, you know, they're just so precious. It's just a little picture of your child when they were very small. And as Amanda said, these things stick around for a lifetime often. And, you know, she mentioned cats, and I was thinking that another example of this kind of thing is the names of our pets. They often evolve. You know, you give the pet a name like we heard from a listener who first called their pet, their cat Orange Juice, and then eventually the cat's name was Lanny because it went from Orange Juice to Juice to Foos to Poos to Pusillanimous to Lanny Mouse. And then to Lanny. And these are things that the family shared and nobody else did. And that's what's so precious about it.
I wonder if the cat was cool with all of that. I don't know. Hard to tell, though.
And if there's food involved, I think they'd be okay.
Yeah. Do we see that kind of evolution in the words within a family very often? Because I think I can think of examples like that in my own family where it started as one thing. And then 3 years later, it's been through 20 steps and it's something completely different.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's often the case.
Thanks for your call, Amanda. Mark joins us now in Menominee. Mark, what did you want to share with us?
So when my oldest son was really young, he super loved Pringles, but he would only leave like one or two chips in the bottom of it. And so the phrase, you Pringled that, came about. And so now whenever there's anything with like one or two things left, even today is like, dude, who Pringled the cheese? Who Pringled the chip?
I am totally stealing that. That is fantastic.
Yeah, Mark,
I'm guilty of that as well, Mark.
And you keep saying it now, Mark. Is this something you've said in front of other people, not family members, and they kind of do a double take?
We get all kinds of weird looks. It happens, you know, at the restaurant. It happens at other people's houses. Yeah, of course.
Thanks a lot. That is a great one, Mark. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Martha, I mean, do we think it happens sometimes that word might start at the family or local group level, but somehow goes viral, even maybe before the internet, and starts to spread into the language?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, you know, expressions like FHB, I don't know if your family ever used that. I think early on that was pretty localized for family hold back. You know, if you have guests over and you want to kind of give a subtle message to everybody around the table that they shouldn't take food so that the guests can have enough.
FHB.
FHB or FLO, flow, family layoff. They're little things that family members can say to each other and other people don't get it. You know, sort of like that look when you're invited to somebody's house and maybe you do something to catch your partner's eye and tell them you want to go.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jean is with us now in Madison. Jean, hi.
Hi. I'm calling about boogeyman names.
Oh.
Now, do you have unique ones in your family, Jean?
Well, I grew up outside of Fond du Lac in a neighborhood where we sort of ran wild in the 60s and 70s, and we had a boogeyman named Butchum Beerium Beer.
And I did you make no that idea. Name up?
Well, I don't know. I was kind of the youngest of the group, so I thought, do other people call the boogeyman that? But I've never seen it written, so it's one of those. Yeah, it's kind of, yeah. So, yeah, it was fun, but I still think about him.
Interesting. Gee, I'm a little scared now. Gene, thanks for calling in. I never thought about that, Martha. Do different parts of the country or maybe even different families have their own versions of the boogeyman or boogeymen?
Oh, there are so many boogeyman words. I mean, I'm thinking in the South, sometimes there's a reference to the Willipus Wallopus, which is this multi-legged creature that will come and get the bad children. Or Snollygoster is another one that haunts, the countryside looking for children who have misbehaved. Parents have been coming up with those words for a long time, and sometimes they're widespread, but I could see, a mom or dad coming up with a word themselves to keep those kids in line.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Martha Barnett from A Way with Words, looking at those words and phrases unique to maybe one family or one group of close friends. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Sharon joins us now in Appleton. Sharon, what do you have for us?
Hi there. I have a contraction mess up that my boys did when they were little. 18 months apart, they kind of learned to talk together. And when they were saying, I am not, instead of saying, I'm not, they'd say, I am'n't. No, I am'n't. And it was just their way of saying it. They're teenagers now, and it still slips out.
Fantastic,
no,
Sharon.
No, I am'n't.
I am'n't. And Martha, I love this one because it, by the rules of contractions, it should work, right? Are not, aren't, am not, why not am'n't?
Right. And I think you will find that in some dictionaries, am'n't.
Thanks. And of course, I mean, the way that the English language has solved it informally is to go with ain't, Martha.
Yes.
Somebody started that at one point, right?
Yes. Yes. That ain't has been around for a very, very long time, and it doesn't bother me at all. I'm thinking this reminds me also of we've had several calls from parents whose kids are told to behave, and the kids will say, I am being have. they're misunderstanding the word, and I just love those misunderstandings that end up being things that last forever in a family.
Sharon, thanks for calling. I am it. Sorry that you called. Kay joins us next in Madison. Kay, hello.
Yes, two things. We had a dog that we called Skippy, because he was like peanut butter colored. And my sister broke her arm several times, and so she always had casts on her arms. And she also had smelly feet, and we would just tell her that it was Mr. Stinky or Mr. Smell.
Okay.
what her body was smelling like.
Oh, no. How did she feel about that, Kay?
Well, I was older, so I thought that was a good thing. They didn't call me that. We called it to her.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. And Martha, I'm guessing hopefully a good-natured ribbing among siblings can lead to words and phrases that catch on within a family.
Sure. That one sounds, sometimes people do go by the name, especially in certain parts of the country, people will go by a name like Stinky for a long time.
I don't aspire to that. Kay, thanks a lot for the call. Jill is with us now in Rice Lake. Jill, hi.
Hi. Hold on. I have two things. My oldest son, when he was little, could not say these things, and he said them so cute that we still use it today. And one is grinkle, grinkle, little doll.
Instead of twinkle, twinkle, right?
I think we got that one, yeah.
Yeah, and Ecrebity Hulk.
Ecrebity, like Incredible Hulk. Oh, okay, so that's kind of like the spaghetti paschetti sort of thing. But Jill, you say you've kept singing, what is it, Grinkle Grinkle over the years?
Grinkle Grinkle Little Doll is the way we've taught it to grandchildren. And Ecrebity Hulk, that's just who he is.
Excellent, Jill. Oh, so that's another one in our category of mispronunciations that become the accepted pronunciation, Martha.
Yeah, and you know, this is reminding me of an email that we got years ago from a listener who and I would suggest this for your listeners. She compiled a 33-page document of all of these family sayings and words when the kids were growing up in the 1950s and 60s. And it's just this thing that the whole family treasures now. You know, one of the kids misunderstood New Mexico as New Mixing Bowl. So they would talk about wanting to go to New Mixing Bowl, or they referred to the newscaster, Walter Cronkite, as Waffle Cornflake. And these things, you know, or a post-it note as a Peely Deely. And again, it's like a family photo album. It's a really, I think, great exercise.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, what's your example?
Hi. When my daughter was, I don't know, about five, we were playing school. She was the teacher. I was the student. I did a picture or something for her. And then a little while later, she said, Mama, how do you make, what letter makes the J sound? And I said, well, it could be a G or a J. What are you doing? No, nothing. And then she handed me my picture back with a grade on the top. And it said, good gob.
And did you stick with that,
good
Susie? Good gob?
Well, we still say it. And she's like a lead nurse in Milwaukee Hospital now. And she occasionally will commend her other nurses when they do something quality. Good gob.
Oh.
I mean, I had to explain to them what it was because they thought, what? You know.
Oh, that's a great example, Susie. Thank you so much. Martha, just a few moments left. You collect these kind of things at Away With Words, right? People can go to your website and share their unique words with you?
Absolutely. Yeah, waywardradio.org. You can mail it to us at words@waywardradio.org. We'd love to hear more about these. The list goes on and on. I don't think we've Pringled this yet.
Oh, you did a good job today, Martha. Thanks for joining us.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
It's Martha Barnett, co-host of Away With Words. You can hear that here on the Ideas Network Sunday mornings at 9. You can keep sharing your unique words and phrases you share with your family and close friends on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, Wisconsin is one of just three states that automatically tries 17-year-old defendants as adults. We'll look at how that affects future incidents of crime and society as a whole. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of people say they plan to work after retirement. Far fewer people actually do. That's just one finding of a new survey that shows a mismatch between our beliefs about retirement and the reality for people who are actually retired. Now, a new report from the organization Human Rights for Kids finds that Wisconsin has the second highest percentage in the nation of prisoners who are incarcerated for crimes committed when they were 17 years old or younger. Wisconsin is one of just three states, along with Texas and Georgia, that automatically tries 17-year-olds in adult court. The research has found this may increase the likelihood of future crimes. We're talking about the criminal justice system here in Wisconsin and how it works for youth offenders, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think 17-year-olds should be tried as adults in some or all cases? What changes do you want to see to the juvenile criminal justice system here in Wisconsin? Is this something that's affected you personally or maybe a family member? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Michael Caldwell is a recently retired lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison and a former senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
So we've got over 7% of the people who are incarcerated in Wisconsin being there for crimes they committed with 17 or younger, second highest rate in the nation. Can you talk about the significance of that number?
Well, I think it's a reflection of the statutory structure that we have where 17-year-olds are considered to be adults for prosecution, for anything else like buying a car or anything else, they're still considered to be a child. But so as a result, that by itself puts a lot of 17-year-olds into the system. And then, of course, there's always a problem with how you deal with younger kids, 16, 15-year-olds who do particularly terrible crimes, who do homicides or armed robberies or things like that. And so exactly what's the best way to proceed with that? If you have them in a traditional juvenile commitment, you only have them under supervision until 18 or in some cases into the early 20s. But for a lot of crimes, that seems like a fairly short period of time to really get adequate rehabilitation. So it's a reflection of the structure of the particular statutes in the state and the way that we allocate our resources.
And as I mentioned, Wisconsin just one of three states that automatically treats 17-year-olds as adults. Do other states have, I guess, more of an optional system where depending on the crime or the particular case, a 17-year-old could be treated as a juvenile or an adult?
That's right. Virtually all states, I think all states, have a mechanism where a 17-year-old or a 16-year-old who commits a particularly bad crime can be moved into adult court and handled as an adult. And in some states, that's requires a petition from the prosecutor. In other states, they have different mechanisms. So typically, though, it goes to some sort of a hearing, and a judge makes a determination as to whether it's best to handle this case in juvenile court or adult court.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of having this 17-year-old automatically treated as an adult in Wisconsin? It goes back, I believe, to a law passed in the 1990s?
That's right. In the 1990s, beginning in the late 80s and into the mid-90s, we saw a huge jump in homicides and violent crimes by adolescents, by teens in the United States. And there was a lot of misunderstanding about that. That's where the super predator scare kind of got going. And almost every state adopted some kind of statute changes to try to be more restrictive with adolescents and to try to crack down on this. And Wisconsin made a number of changes in our laws, including moving 17-year-olds into adult court. Part of the thinking there was, at that point, we had two juvenile institutions, Ethan Allen, two secured juvenile institutions, Ethan Allen and Lincoln Hills, and I guess there was a third for girls. Those were both way over census and struggling to keep up. It was costing counties a lot of money to house kids in those facilities. And so part of the hope was that if we moved the 17-year-olds out of those facilities and into the adult system, that would free up money for prevention programs at the county level. That was one of the considerations. It didn't actually work. We didn't see a drop-off in admissions to those facilities. What we did see, though, was by the time that law was fully enacted and put into place, we were about 3 or 4 years into a decline in juvenile violence and in violence across the board. And that decline continued for the next 20 or 25 years until just very recently. And it had really nothing to do with tightening up those laws. And in fact, in some ways, it looks as though some of those more restrictive laws backfired. So most states have backed away from those 1990 laws and changed it so that they have moved 16 and 17-year-olds back into the juvenile system and made it a little bit different as far as how kids are waived into adult court and a number of other changes. Wisconsin has not made, I don't think, it made many changes to those laws that we passed in the 1990s.
And Michael, I wanted to ask, we've got just about 30 years, I guess, of evidence now. What do we know about if we incarcerate that 17-year-old versus going to the juvenile system? What have we learned about whether they're likely to commit another crime in the future?
Yeah, this has been studied in a number of places. I'm not sure if there's been a specific study done in Wisconsin, but it's been thoroughly examined in lots of other places. And what we find is that the kid who is actually transferred into the adult system is actually slightly more likely to commit another crime once they get out. It actually aggravates the situation. For juveniles in general, or teenagers in general, the idea that they might be waived into adult court doesn't seem to have any deterrent effect, doesn't slow them down or prevent them from committing crimes. So one of the problems with these waiver laws is that they don't seem to be effective at reducing crime at all, and may have a marginal effect on increasing crime down the road. The other issue is that across the board, when you put very young individuals into the adult prison system, they just, with long sentences, they do very, very poorly. They have much higher rates of suicide. They get into a lot more fights. They're victimized a lot more. They just have a very tough time making that adjustment because, for a lot of reasons, but especially if you're 17 and you are facing, say, a 20-year prison sentence, that's longer than you've been alive. And it's hard for a 17-year-old not to just lose any sense of hope and not see much point in participating in rehabilitation programming and some of those kinds of things. So you routinely see very poor adjustment in those first few years with these young guys.
We're finding out why Wisconsin's criminal justice system is an outlier and how it deals with 17-year-old defendants and the impact on younger people in the courts. Our guest is Michael Caldwell, former lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison, former senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think Wisconsin should handle juvenile offenders, those under 18? What works, do you think? What doesn't? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Michael Caldwell, former lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison, former senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center, taking a look at the impacts of trying 17-year-olds as adults. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one been through the juvenile criminal justice system in Wisconsin or tried as an adult at age 17? Can you share your thoughts on that experience? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Ray is with us in Milwaukee. Ray, hello.
Hi. I want to bring up the statistics from the FBI for last year for Milwaukee and just kind of open everybody's eyes about what we're talking about here in Milwaukee. The FBI statistics from last year clearly show Milwaukee has a higher murder rate per 100,000 people than the city of Chicago. I am 61. I've lived here my whole life. I have never, ever seen things as bad as they are right now in Milwaukee. Teenagers are a huge part of this totally out of control crime. Every other day, you see teenagers stealing cars and crashing them in the wildest videos. I say, if you're 14, 15, you go to adult prison. If you want to do adult crimes like murder, carjacking, some drug dealing, you should get the book thrown at you, lock you up, throw away the keys.
Ray, I gotcha. Michael, what do you think? Ray perceives, and there are some numbers, especially with those homicide rates in Milwaukee, they have certainly gone up in recent years.
Yeah, in the last couple of years, since COVID, we've seen a number of cities that have had spikes in their homicide rates and also these auto theft kind of a fad among some teens that's promoted by videos on social media and the like. And the caller's reaction is, I think, a natural. This is the way that people almost always react to crime. It's if you've ever been a crime victim, your first reaction is you want that the person that harmed you to suffer, and so it's a completely understandable feeling, and it's one of those things that it does drive a lot of these laws that we've seen passed going back into the 1990s. The other side of the coin, of course, is that we've had this situation in Wisconsin for a long time. As you mentioned, we have some of the highest rates of adolescents going into the adult prison system, and we still have this spike in homicides and car thefts and violent crime. It doesn't seem to have protected us at all in that regard. And that's consistent with the broader research that, although it does make us feel like there's some justice to that's inflicted on people who have done bad things, it doesn't seem to prevent things getting worse, and doesn't head off the next crime victim, prevent them from suffering that harm.
Thanks for the call, Ray. Andy is with us next in Appleton. Andy, hello.
Hi, there's a real movement towards, just like the last caller said, to impose mandatory sentences and throw the book at them as if that's going to make a difference in the crime rate. But recently, Tommy Thompson, who really pushed truth in sentencing in the same mentality, said he really regrets that and ended up didn't do anything to change the crime rates, because when people are going through this crime, they don't think about those things. And it's really blown out the state budget as far as how many people we have in prison and taking care of them. So he regretted that push under truth in sentencing just the last couple of months.
Thanks for that call, Andy. And I believe the former governor had also advocated for ending treating all 17-year-olds as adults in the court system. Your thoughts on that, Michael?
Yeah, the push for moving young offenders, 17-year-olds, back into the juvenile system has the interesting thing about this is that it really isn't a Democratic position or a Republican position. There doesn't seem to be a particularly clear-cut status as far as the politics of it. We've seen quite a bit of push from fiscal conservatives on the right, who recognize that this is just a waste of taxpayer money. It's an ineffective way to try to manage the problem, just as Governor Thompson was alluding to. And of course, on the other side, we've seen advocacy groups like the group that produced this report talking about the fact that it's inconsistent with international standards on the treatment of children and human rights and those kinds of things. It seems to be that we can't move the ball forward on this and address it in a way that's more effective. It's not just simply a bad policy, partially because we are so locked into this retributive system that we have. But I think that the area, the side that is most likely to move these policies in a more effective direction actually is the fiscal conservatives on the right. They seem to have been able to make the most progress on actually changing some of these policies.
Thanks for the call, Andy. Sheila joins us next in Milwaukee. Sheila, hello.
Hi. I was strong-arm carjacked a month and a half ago. They targeted me and followed me into my driveway. At any rate, I was beat up pretty bad, and I fought back, which was probably not the smartest thing to do at 50 years old, but I did anyway. And the point being is I don't believe that a 17-year-old, if we're going to make them adults at 17, then make it a clear-cut line. Now you're an adult at 17. What is the point of being 17 if you're not still an adolescent? The young man that attacked me was 16 years old, and I don't feel these kids feel that they're loved in Milwaukee. You know, we used to have things in the justice system like the boot camps and other things to rehabilitate them, and we don't have those things to offer them anymore. We have nothing for these kids to do. They're not supposed to be in the parks after 9 o'clock at night. Well, that's great. We used to play Ghost in the Graveyard when we were kids. We did all kinds of things like that. But we had the opportunity to do those things, and they don't. So if we're not going to give them things to do and make it constructive, then there is no point. I mean, if we're not going to grab these kids by their bootstraps and make them respect and respond and feel loved and want to love life, because they have no respect for their own lives.
And Sheila, I'm so sorry you went through that, and thanks for being willing to share it. For the 16-year-old person who attacked you, I mean, do you feel with your mind or with your heart they should be tried as an adult? They shouldn't? Are you mixed on that? I don't know.
Absolutely not. No, he's still a child.
Sheila, thank you so much for calling in. And Michael, interesting, certainly, perspective there. And Sheila, feeling we need solutions before we get to this stage of asking the question whether this kid should be in prison.
Yeah, that's right. And I want to echo your feeling. I'm sorry that that happened to the caller. But it is these are difficult issues because these kids do commit some very violent and heinous crimes. So it's not just that we should feel sorry for them or those kinds of things. At the end of the day, a lot of times the things that lead states to make these changes is that they just simply recognize that these are ineffective policies that cost an awful lot of taxpayer money. It's just you're just burning money and not accomplishing much. The other issue here is that we know now, over the last 30 years or so, we've seen some very, very effective rehabilitation programs that have been developed and studied and can work even with fairly violent kids in the community, and also with the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center's studies showing that even the most violent kids, the most difficult to manage kids, if they're treated in the right, using the right methods, we can reduce the risk of violent recidivism by half. But at that point, as the caller kind of alluded, once the kid does a crime, you're quite a ways down the road, and it would be ideal to have programming that happens earlier and prevents that first crime from even happening. And that's in some ways a little bit harder to work out, but it's also the more fertile ground to try to spend your energy in.
Thanks again for calling in. Pete joins us next in Wausau. Pete, hello.
Hello, Dr. Caldwell. I find it interesting that the system and the laws that you mentioned that changed in the 1990s and the juxtaposition between what we know now about adolescent brain development and risk of recidivism as far as conducting intake evaluations and assigning risk assessments or assigning risk levels of maximum and medium and so on and so forth.
And I got to jump in because we're just about out of time. But Michael, adolescent brain development and how we evaluate future risk when somebody's brought into the court system.
And that's an important consideration because when you have someone in, say serving a 10-year prison sentence in the adult system, it just makes sense not to give them, say, anger management or alcohol and drug treatment in the first year and then have them sit for 9 years until you release them. So a lot of those services are held until they're close to release. The trouble is that we know from adolescent brain studies that the younger adults and teenagers are most likely to change in those early years, in those teen years. And so the most effective place to put that treatment into place and work on that rehabilitation is when they're younger. And so that's how the juvenile system is structured. You have rehabilitation built into everything the kid goes through from day one. And in the adult system, of course, for very logical reasons, it's often held until near the end. So taking advantage of that neurodevelopment and also recognizing that kids, adolescents, just simply don't have the same capacity to control some of those impulses, to think rationally, and just to manage their behavior and manage risk and see the potential harms that could come. They just simply don't have the same capacity that an adult does. And that will develop as they get older.
Pete, thanks a lot for that call. And Michael, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Michael Caldwell, recently retired lecturer in psychology at UW-Madison, former senior staff psychologist at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center. He talked to us about why Wisconsin's one of just three states that automatically tries 17-year-olds as adults. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, electricity rates went up this year for many people here in Wisconsin. Find out what the rate increase means for you and how those prices are set in the first place. And if you've noticed, if you're feeling that increase, love to hear from you. You can email right now at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Have you ever loved a TV show so much that you wish you could have the set from that TV show in your own house? Yeah, me neither. But in a new auction, you can do exactly that. A longtime collector of TV stuff is putting lots of things up for auction, including the bar and counter from the 80s TV show Cheers, interview sets from David Letterman and Johnny Carson, and the living room from All in the Family, plus props and costumes from a zillion TV shows. That's not enough for you? You need more? How about the whole house from The Brady Bunch? It's up for sale after an HGTV renovation for $5.5 million. Five bedrooms, five baths. The Central Time team raised the question, are there toilets in those bathrooms? The answer is yes, though you wouldn't know it from the TV show from 50-ish years ago. Toilets and flushing sounds, they're seen as too crude to be shared on TV back then. Times change. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.